Trigger warning. This podcast discusses themes centered around emotional, physical, and sexual violence. While the stories of the survivors are meant to be inspiring and informative, listener discretion is advised. If you are struggling with any of the aforementioned issues, links to resources can be found in the show notes of today's episode.
So I didn't want that out there. At the time, I had been with Jeff every day for a year, so I felt like he was my friend. I just didn't like what he did to me. It wasn't like I didn't like him. I just didn't like what he did. And so I was upset at what my father had done because he exposed all this. Looking back 40 years, and I told the classroom today, you know, the fact that 40 years later, people look at my father's shooting and killing a man as an act of love, not an act of hate.
Hi, survivors. I'm Tara Newell.
And I'm Collier Landry, and this is the Survivor Squad Podcast.
Yay, another episode.
Another episode, Tara. Another episode. And we just wrapped up the true crime podcasting course, right?
Oh, yes. No, I was so excited to do that. We had so many great people involved. Justin from Generation Y, Strictly Stalking was involved, Navigating Advocacy, Murder Diaries, and so many other people. And even though we ended it, we stopped doing the lives for it, you can purchase the course anytime on my website, taranewellsurvival.com. So check it out if you guys want to start a podcast.
Yes, yes. And this week's guest we have, this is going to be our last episode for a while. We are going to go on about a 4-month hiatus until the summer. And this is our guest, Jody Ploche, who came to us from Tyler Allen from Minds of Madness. This is his friend Jody, who he's told me for years, you gotta talk to this guy. He's got a wild story. And what a wild story it is. Tara, you want to tell our audience what it's about?
Yes. So Jody Ploche from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, made national headlines in March 1984 when he was abducted by his karate teacher and taken 2,000 miles away from his home to Los Angeles, California. The FBI officials rescued Jody and his abductor was arrested. Upon this karate teacher's return, Jody's father, Gary, shot and killed him. The shooting was captured by WBRZ News crew, a local ABC affiliate, and it was all on camera.
Jody's dad was waiting in the airport for his abductor to be returned, and he just timed it and took his life right there in front of. It's a wild, wild story, but and this has obviously become a point of advocacy for Jody moving forward. He ended up obtaining his bachelor's degree in general studies from Louisiana State University with minors in psychology, speech communications, and philosophy. And then Jody had started working in the field of violence prevention since 1995. And while he was attending Louisiana State University, he served on the executive board for Men Against Violence, a campus organization aimed at preventing campus violence, including sexual assault and other physical violence. For 7 years, Jody worked at Victim Services of Montgomery County, a comprehensive crime victim center in Norristown, Pennsylvania. At Victim Services, Jody worked as a sexual assault counselor as well as a prevention educator and eventually became a supervisor of community education programs. Jody provided crisis intervention to sexual assault victims on the agency's 24-hour crisis hotline as well as in-person support at hospitals and police stations.
He facilitated sexual violence risk reduction programs to students ranging from pre-K through college age. Jody also presented numerous professional trainings for police officers, hospital staff, parents, and school administrators.
So Tara, what do you say we get into Jody's incredible story of his abduction and what he did next with his life?
Yes, let's get into it.
All right, so Daddy goes, he made it out to False River, and he's talking to his best friend. He keeps calling his best friend Jim Adams. His nickname was Stinky. So Daddy's calling Stinky, you know, I'm going to kill him. Stinky's trying to talk him down. Daddy's like, I'm going to the airport. So Daddy gets in his car, he goes to the airport, he sits down, he has a couple beers, and contrary to the misinformation, he wasn't drunk, he wasn't shit-faced. You know, he had a couple beers. And so while he was there, I guess he saw a camera crew come in. And so they went upstairs because it was upstairs. So they went upstairs. So I guess daddy followed him upstairs and then the camera crew set up. And so my dad was like, all right, so they're going to be coming by here. So then he went and got on the payphones across from the camera because he figured that's the best place to see them walk by. And if you look carefully, when Jeff and Bud come walking around the corner, the wall is white. Well, then where the payphones were, the wall went in about 3 or 4 feet. So it almost was like you couldn't see what was behind that wall where the payphones were. So, and if you watch again, watch Mike. Mike is the first cop. Mike, you can see him wave Bud and Jeff over, like, come on, okay, it's safe. I don't see Gary. But you can still see him behind, looking behind the lights, and then he kind of moves his head forward. Well, the lights came on to get the film. Well, my dad being an ex-cameraman, he's like, he's on the phone, oh, he's coming. And so my dad kind of used his sunglasses. He looked behind his back, and he was watching, and he could see him come walking. And so whenever the light shined directly even with him, he knew that's why his turn is so perfectly timed and he just drops to Jeff. And Bud, the other cop, he got like blood splatter on his head, and Bud didn't know my dad. And if you watch it, Bud, I would see Bud here, you know, over the years. He died a couple months ago, but him and Mike used to go to Twin Peaks all the time, and Bud sat down with me for a couple hours and we talked, and he was like, I was going to shoot your dad. He goes, I really was. He goes, if that camera wasn't there, I would have shot him. He goes, you watch the video. I take the gun and I put it in the top of his head and I call him a son of a bitch. And then he turns around and goes to Jeff. So Bud, I think, eventually forgave him because my brother and sister, they graduated with Bud's son from high school. And so one time at the football game, my dad saw Bud and Bud didn't like my dad, meanwhile. And so my dad just looked at Bud and goes, like that, just because that's how my dad was. And Bud got pissed off.
So Jeff comes around the corner with Bud and Mike.
Mike was up front.
That was your father's friend who came to the house to speak to your mother.
Yes.
And your father, Gary Ploche, timed it perfectly and shot Jeff in the head, correct?
Yep. One shot behind the ear. It was with a .38 caliber snub-nosed revolver. I was telling the students today that 38 was Jeff's unlucky number because we were in room 38 and daddy was 38 years old when he shot him with a 38.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
That's wild. And this was on camera?
It was videotaped. All right. If you watch the unedited version, which is on my website, www.jodyploche.net, it's not a real good website, but it's still up there. You can see at the 1:04 mark, and this is brilliant, the cameraman changes tapes. So he takes out the tape of the shooting and puts it in his bag and he puts in another tape. Reason being, if the cops came to him and said, hey, we need that tape, he was going to give them the tape without the shooting and take the shooting to the airport. I mean, to the news station.
Side note, I'm a cinematographer and we do that trick all the time when we're filming and we know the cops are going to bust us. We swap out the cards in the camera or the magazine in the camera so we can save it in case somebody...
Is that something y'all are taught?
It's sort of like an unspoken rule. Like if the cops are coming and you've got film and you're going to get busted for permits or anything, you swap it out because the cops aren't going to know the difference. You're going to hand them the thing. Oh, sorry, officer. Here's the card. My bad. I'm sorry. We were filming. You always save it. It's like an instinctive thing.
I thought it was brilliant. I'm like, here, 1:04 after, you know, filming a man get his head blown off, you know, he was like, oh, let me change the tape.
Exactly why he did it.
And so of course, you know, the cops, you know, rush my dad, they arrest him, they book him with attempted second degree murder because Jeff technically wasn't dead, even though he was dead before he hit the floor. They kept him on life support, and so he died on St. Patrick's Day. So technically he died on St. Patrick's Day, but like I said, he died when my dad parked the car at the airport. Pretty much they brought my dad to Parrish prison. He shot him on a Friday night and he couldn't post bail till Monday. He posted bail first thing Monday morning. He ended up going to a psychiatric facility for 3 to 4 weeks, and then he came back home. And after that, he didn't lose his job. He went back to work at the same job he had. He drove the company car.
He drove the company car to the airport?
Yeah, he did.
Wow.
And here's an unconfirmed story, but this is what I heard as a kid growing up. So he worked at a place called Head and Inquist. And now, if you watch an LSU football game, Head and Inquist will be on the coach's earphones. It's grown into a pretty big company. And at the time, John Inquist, the owner, was in Dallas meeting with a prospective client. And so the client goes, hey, John, did you hear about that shooting in Baton Rouge? And John was like, yeah. And he goes, they ought to give that man a key to the city. That man's a hero. And John was like, well, you know, he's my number one salesman. Like, so that, at that point he couldn't fire my dad.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
I mean, I guess he could have, but I mean, at that point he was like, well, I guess I got my decision made. I'm going to keep him.
So I want to take a moment to point out that this is a very challenging situation. I don't have children. I know how I would probably feel, how conflicted I would be if one of my nephews had experienced this. And maybe, you know, I've been through a lot, so I don't know how I would handle it. I would hope not. You referenced A Time to Kill earlier in the interview. And I think about that a lot, actually, because these types of crimes perpetrated on children seem to be coming more and more commonplace, or at least we're finding, maybe learning about them more and more with the internet. You know, your father, in essence, took the law into his own hands.
Absolutely.
And I feel like, you know, this is 1984, where that's 40 years ago. It almost seemed as though your father was fated because of this in a lot of ways, versus today, it might be an entirely different situation.
You know, when it comes to my dad, just his personality, the people that he knew, you know, again, if we could fast forward to where my dad was 30 years old, I'm 11 years old, Jeff's 25 years old, and I still think he would get away with it. Like, I don't think even today, let's see what happens with Cain Velasquez. I don't think Cain Velasquez is going to jail. He shot the wrong guy. You know, I don't think you're going to find a jury that's going to, you know, convict my father 12 to nothing. That wasn't going to happen then, and it wouldn't happen now.
Especially, I think, in the area where it took place, too. You're talking about, you know, Louisiana. It's a very red state.
Yeah.
There's a lot of...
We don't like them pedophiles around here.
Well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, they call it Texas justice, right? You're not too far away. It's interesting. And I think also it's very fortunate that your father obviously knew how to handle a firearm and no one else was injured, because no one else was, correct? There was no...
Nope.
I mean, he's very lucky because it could have turned out a lot different. So you said your father didn't lose his job. He went to a psych hospital. Like you said, he went to the Paris correctional facility till he posted bail. So did he go to trial? Like, what happened with his story? Was he ever brought up in charges?
Initially, they charged him with second-degree murder. And he had a lawyer, it was a friend of his who was, you know, representing pro bono, who was offered a plea deal with no jail time, and he wouldn't take it. And so I remember now, it's probably a little bit more information. I don't care. They're dead. It doesn't matter. And so I remember coming home from school in middle school and my dad coming up with the old answer machine, and he clicked a button. He's like, Gary, this is the judge. You need to meet me in my office at 10 o'clock tomorrow. And so the judge called him and said, you got to meet me in his office. And what it was is Foxy wasn't accepting a deal, you know, with no jail time, because Foxy had signed a book deal, and the book deal was contingent upon the trial so that it would be public record. And so
who is Foxy? Sorry.
Foxy was my dad's lawyer that was represented in pro bono.
Got it.
And so that was his friend. So the judge was basically like, look, you know, and actually it was a psychiatrist that told my dad, do you trust me? And my dad said, yeah. He said, will you do what I tell you to do? And he said, yeah. And he said, you got to fire Foxy, because Foxy kind of sold him out. Because if you're facing life in prison and they offer you a deal with no jail time, whether it's 100 years probation, you take it.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so my dad fired Foxy, got Anthony Mirabella, who later became a judge here in Baton Rouge. And Anthony Mirabella was able to finalize and work out that deal. And so, you know, my dad, to the day he died, you know, had the utmost respect for Anthony Mirabella for helping him. And you know, I was at the funeral for my father, and I got word Anthony Mirabella was dead, and that's when I finally entered into the church to go say hello to him. So, I mean, there was a lot of, you know, respect, because the man literally saved our family.
Yeah.
Your father's attorney was opportunistic and yes. had seen dollar signs and said, okay, I'm signing a book deal. I'm going to represent this man. And he wanted to obviously take it to trial because it would raise the profile of the case and therefore raise the interest in his book and his own personal gain.
Right.
No matter what happened to his client, he really didn't give a shit. He wanted fame and money and success. I mean,
I will say this. I mean, he probably was like everybody else, thinking that no one's going to convict my dad. So this is a win case. So why not sign the book deal. So, I mean, I can't really fault him for that, especially if he was doing it pro bono. Okay, you know what? Go make money off the book. But you don't risk someone's freedom for a book.
No.
Yeah. Like, maybe do it after the trial and everything. That's, you know, the time for that. That's when you can gain notoriety from the case, you know?
Absolutely. You know, unfortunately, it was 35 years before my book came out, but at least I think I got a good product. I think it came out really well. There's a lot of good information for parents. There's a good information for survivors. People who've never experienced something like that, they can kind of get a general understanding. And that was my goal. And I try to put some humor into it because, you know, child rape, kidnapping, and murder can, you know, kind of bring you down a little bit. So I try to put some, you know, moments of humor.
Yeah, it's heavy subject matter for sure.
We're not done with the story just yet. So my dad eventually pled no contest to manslaughter, and the Doucette family agreed to the, because he was facing up to 15 years, I believe. And so when it came time for sentencing, the judge sentenced my dad to 7 years hard time, suspended, with 300 hours community service and 5 years probation. And part of his probation was he couldn't drink. So my mother took him back because they had split up that summer because of his drinking. My mother took him back and he didn't get caught drinking again until after his probation was up. So,
and then if I'm not mistaken, you had some feelings around what happened as well, right?
Well, at first I was upset when my father shot Jeff because there's several reasons. One, nobody except for my mother that I knew about the sexual abuse and my dad. Okay. Daddy shooting Jeff brought that to light. I'm in sixth grade. I got to go face my classmates. And now the world's going to know that a man had, you know, sodomized me and performed oral sex. That's out there. And so I didn't want that out there. So that, and you know, at the time I had been with Jeff every day for a year. So I felt like he was my friend. I just didn't like what he did to me. It wasn't like I didn't like him. I just didn't like what he did. And so at first I was upset at what my father had done because he exposed all this. Looking back 40 years, and I told the classroom today, you know, the fact that 40 years later, people look at my father's shooting and killing a man is an act of love, not an act of hate. And my dad stands as a great symbol for justice. You know, so many people are victimized or screwed over the system. You know, y'all got lucky. I got lucky. Daddy got lucky. So, you know, it's just one of those things where when people like it, people get happy when they see Jeff get shot. And so I'd be willing to trade the fact that I wanted him to go to jail for the rest of his life for people to still be, you know. So February 17th, it's 3 days ago, two people tweeted out the video of my father. I got a friend from a friend of mine, Chris Duet. I did his podcast. He did Perspectives. Criminal Perspectives was his old podcast. And he texted me, he's like, your dad's trending, or, you know, viral, went viral again on Twitter. And so I started tracking it. And over 48 hours, those two videos got 64.5 million views. I mean, that's pretty incredible. And that's going on the 40th anniversary. I mean, 40 years later to get that many views. So, I mean, people, it just makes them feel good that, you know, the good guys got the justice.
Yeah, like I hate to give any opinions about survivor stories because, you know, every survivor is unique and every survivor should feel the way that they feel. But I'm not going to lie, when I saw that, I was kind of like, yeah, I probably do the same thing.
Or at least want to.
Yeah.
I think it was the first time I went on Maury. No, it was the second time I went on Maury. And I was on the, it was, oh, it was for the, did you see the movie An Eye for an Eye with Sally Fields and Kiefer Sutherland, where I think, you know, he killed her daughter and she takes revenge on Eye for an Eye? Well, that was, we watched that movie before we went out and did the show. And so we were on the panel and there was a woman next to me and she's like, Maury's like, so you've seen that video of Gary Ploche shooting Jeff. She said, she goes, I went out and rented it and I watched it. And I watched it over and over, and it inspired me. I was going to go kill the man that killed my dog. I was like, good Lord. You know, so, I mean, I guess it's done that as well, too.
Does that feel weird?
Yeah, it was. It felt a little weird that I was like, you know, she's using it as an inspiration. Like that's kind of weird. But, I mean, if you watch it and you feel good because justice was served and the man didn't go to jail, that's one thing. But to be like, I was going to kill somebody and I used it to motivate myself. yeah, that kind of freaked me out. I think you can even see me like kind of going, oh, on the show. But I did get to meet LaToya Jackson that day.
Oh, that's cool.
They filmed two shows and she was the second show. And so I was like, hey, can I get a seat in the audience? And so he sat me like right up front and you can see me. I'm sitting kind of funny. It's funny when I look at it, I'm like, what was I thinking? I should have known the camera was going to pick me up. But so after the show, since I was on the show and I had to go catch my ride, I was allowed to go backstage with LaToya. And so I was like, hey, can I get a picture? So I got a picture with LaToya Jackson. I mean, at the time I was a huge Michael Jackson fan.
Of course.
So to meet, you know, sister was like, to me, awesome. But that was when she was estranged from the family because Jack Gordon was her husband and I wouldn't sit next to Jack Gordon. I was like, don't sit me next to him. That was kind of like her manager that like beat her.
Oh.
So speaking of, I mean, obviously Michael Jackson has had a, there's been a lot of accusations and things leveled at him. I find it hard to listen to his music myself nowadays. You know, what do you think about things like that as a survivor?
Well, I'll give you, that wouldn't be a perfect example. I just know that, yeah, I don't really listen. The question is, can you listen to ABC? You know, like at some point, Michael wasn't a child molester. And at one point he was. So can you listen like up to off the wall? And then you say, okay, well now he's molesting children. Can you go to, he wasn't accused of Dangerous album. So is that the one that you can listen to Thriller, but you can't listen to Dangerous? But, I tend not to listen to his music. There's still a few songs that I like, but
you go through all this. You've obviously, were you able to have a normal relationship with your father after this?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It took a couple months, but after about the middle of that summer, we were walking down to the pool and I told my dad, I said, look, I'm not mad at you. I understand why you did what you did. And so I think that meant a lot, but yeah, after that, I mean, you know, he's at every football practice, you know, every game, every basketball practice, every basketball game. I mean, he was just a father, you know.
And nobody in the community had anything to say to him.
I don't know of anybody that ever went to him and was like, you're a murderer. Because, I mean, I guess if he's a murderer, they're not going to tell him because he might murder them. But, no, everyone that ever came up to my father was supportive.
Yeah.
As far as I know. The person who was hardest on themselves was my dad. He'd get drunk and be like, everybody thinks I'm this killer, but I'm not, you know? And so he would get upset that, you know, he took a human life, but
sure.
he didn't regret his actions. He regretted that he had to take those actions. That's what he regretted.
I think that's something I definitely relate to in the aspect that I had to take a human life and that you have to live with that. And, you know, if you don't have that remorse, then I don't think that it's normal.
Yeah.
You then turn right into like, this was wrong. And this was like, you know, you're doing it for the wrong reasons. And just because you said that about his dad, that's your dad. That's something I very much relate to is like, you know, taking that person's life. And I feel bad on days that I had to do that. But in my case, it was like, he came after me with a knife. I like literally just kicked the knife out of his hand, got his own knife from him. And so it was, you know, very different, but similar in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I could understand why my dad would feel that way because, I mean, you know, he did his community service at the church. You know, I tell people my dad believed in all 8 of the 10 commandments, you know, thou shalt not commit adultery and thou shalt not kill, but other 8 he believed in. But that's a joke. But, you know, so, I mean, he did have that Catholic guilt that comes with being Catholic over what he did, you know. But like I said, he never regretted the fact that he did it. Well, I mean, I can imagine you're the same way. I mean, just
yeah. Well, I just got to say, I love your sense of humor and, you know, how you relate back to things because I'm like, yes, yes, you're part of the squad for sure.
Do you think your father would have, do you really think that he wouldn't have faced justice nowadays? Do you think it would have been a different story?
Yeah, well, it would have been, he probably would have had more support. I believe so. If the same facts are the same facts, you know, this man takes his son away, takes him across the country to California. He's caught with, you know, Jeff's DNA inside my body. They'd have had more evidence against Jeff. So if they would have had the evidence of the sodomy, and no, I think my dad would have had actually more support now.
Do you think Jeff would have gotten away with it if he hadn't been shot?
No, because Jeff, dumbass, confessed on the plane. He
did.
Yeah,
got
he confessed to molesting C, D, and me. And he confessed it. Now, in his confession, he lied. He said, oh, maybe he only performed oral sex on me like 10 times.
Sure.
And that's what happened. But no, you know, and maybe we had done the other a couple of times. But no, he did it every day from the time he started. From May to February, he did it every day. So, or almost every day.
It's so interesting because I often talk about like this, never underestimate the predictability of stupidity and how stupid criminals are. But he, as if he thinks that if he only did it once, it doesn't matter. Like it's somehow less of a thing. Well, I only did it once. It's like, no, asshole, you did it once and you're fucked and you're going to jail for the rest of your life or for 20 years.
He asked Mike Burnett, he said, once, you know, this misunderstanding gets straightened out, do you think that I could still, you know, see Jody and I can meet with the kids and talk to them and tell them to get counseling? I'm like, what?
Wow.
No, dude. No, I don't want to talk to you.
Wow. That is, he actually asked the detective that.
Mm-hmm.
That just shows that, you know, you mentioned earlier in the interview that he was a sociopath. That just shows the massive amount of disconnect that he doesn't even think about the consequences of his actions, that someone who he did this to. And how do you share that nowadays with, you know, you said you were at a high school earlier today, you know, you talk to kids regularly, you got involved in activism. Where did all this take you in your life?
Broke, living at home with mommy. I went to work at Victim Services Center in Norristown, Pennsylvania, just outside of Philadelphia. And I like what I do, like a speaking engagement. I like to share a few Montgomery County famous people, like Hall & Oates. They're from Montgomery County. Now, Philadelphia always gets credit, but Daryl Hall was born in Pottstown and John Oates went to North Penn High School. So that's Montgomery County. Bill Cosby was convicted in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. Kobe Bryant went to Lower Merion High School, which is in Montgomery County in Pennsylvania. And Taylor Swift, she was born, I think, in Wyomissing, Pennsylvania, but she grew up on a Christmas tree farm in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania. So just to give you, you know, some celebrities that are from there. And then baseball players, you got Tom Lasorda, Reggie Jackson, Mike Piazza. They're all from that area. Bob Saget was from that.
So am I. I was born in Montgomery County at Bryn Mawr Hospital.
Bryn Mawr?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
There you go. My father went to Lower Merion.
Oh, wow.
There you go. Chuck Barris went to Lower Merion.
Yeah.
J. Russell Peltz went
to
Lower Merion.
And Chuck Berry lived in Paoli next to my aunt.
I didn't even know that. I can put you on your introduction now. I can be right up there with Bob Saget and Eddie George. You know who else is from Montgomery County? Is Mark the Bagger. Do you watch Howard Stern or listen to Howard Stern? Or did you ever used to listen to Howard Stern? Because I don't listen to him anymore. But they had the Whack Pack, and Mark the Bagger used to work at the Acme in Collegeville. And I literally would go shopping at that Acme, and he'd be in there, hey! He had this little high-pitched voice, and he's a little B.O. guy. I'd be at bars and see him. This was before he became part of the Howard Stern show, but I'll throw him in there if I'm in the Northeast where I think people know who Mark the Bagger would be. But yeah, that's awesome. Montgomery County, I loved it, man. That's the best decision I ever made. I'm going to tell you right now, I didn't know a person. I didn't know anybody. But I said, fuck it. And I went up there, got me a place in Royersford. I lived in Royersford for 5 years. I lived in King of Prussia for 2, and I worked in Norristown for 7.
I love all these synchronicities.
King of Prussia Mall in the Bloomingdales in King of Prussia Mall, which was where my mother always told me that she wanted her ashes scattered.
Really? Mm-hmm. And when Taylor Swift was first coming up, if you look back at like Teen Beat magazine or whatever, she talks about going to the King of Prussia Mall because that was like Mecca, like for a teenage girl going to the King of Prussia Mall.
That's a nice mall.
Well, I know that you were talking a little bit about you helping out and speaking to different students. Why don't you talk about the program a little bit more, and then we'll talk about this YES method for consent, because I was reading your book and I love that method.
Yeah, I came up with that at Victim Services Center because I always thought no means no was stupid, but we'll get to that. All right, so what I did today, for example, is I got like a little PowerPoint preview, and I tell people, like, it's for me, it's not for you. It's to keep me on track so I can stay focused, you know, because I can get ahead of myself. I can jump forward, I can jump backwards. And so I use that, and so I'll go through and I'll tell the story, kind of like we did at the beginning. I started taking karate, Rick left and blah, blah, blah. And about halfway through, I'll show the ESPN E60 that they did back in 2013, which they did a really good job with it. My dad was still alive and my uncle was still alive. So it was good to see that. And then,
what do you mean the ESPN E60? I'm confused.
Okay. So if you go to YouTube and type in Jody Ploche, ESPN E60, A Time to Kill, they did like a little 50-minute segment on E60 on ESPN that aired, I want to say September of 2013. And they did a really good job with it. My dad was still alive. You know, they asked him, Tom Rinaldi, if you're familiar with Tom Rinaldi, he came to my house, you know. It's kind of cool because he's always got the pieces in, during the football games that make everybody cry on, you know, game day. Now he's not there anymore. But so he had to come to the house. And then I'll do like a little question and answer. And then the teacher helped facilitate some of the questions. We talked about, you know, the body responding. I think that's important to get out there. I also try to share some funny stories. Like back in 2002, when the church scandal hit, the Boston Globe, remember, have you seen Spotlight, the movie Spotlight?
Of course, Spotlight, yeah.
So when all that was going on, I called my friend Art Harris at CNN and I say, Art, can you see if you're interested in doing a story. You got the church scandal. Now you got this kid whose dad killed somebody who's doing sexual abuse education prevention. And he's a certified sexual assault counselor. And they jumped at the idea. And so they flew up and they wanted to get me doing footage to little kids, doing our no go and tell or our good touch, bad touch. We called it keep it touch as safe and healthy. And so I got a second grade class to agree to let me come in and film everything. Wait, all the kids got their signature, or the parents signed off consent forms and everything. So you go through good touch, which is, or good touches make you feel good, hugs, kisses. Bad touches hurt you, they're punches and kicks. We identify good reasons for a grown-up to touch a child's private parts, like going to the doctor or checking for ticks. And then we get to the part where it's no good reason for an adult to touch a child's private parts, and we call that secret touching. Well, all of a sudden, this little kid raises his hand. Second grader. And I'm like, oh, Lord, I wouldn't have called on him, but I felt pressure because I had the correspondent, the cameraman, the sound guy, the producer, the principal, guidance counselor, and teacher all watching me do this presentation. So I made this mistake of calling on the little shit. And he goes, sometimes you can secret touch yourself.
Oh.
And I was like, kid, I'm 35 and single. You don't have to tell me about that. I know what I really said was that you're touching yourself. It's not a secret, but you know, I'm thinking to myself like, good Lord, why did I call on him? But I thought I handled it pretty well. And we got through and they used a little clip. They should a little.
I thought you were going to say something a lot different.
Oh, well, I've done that too. I've been like, okay, what's a good reason for a grown up to touch a child's private parts? And I had two like kindergartners. One said yeast infection. Another said catheterized. So you do get those kind of, you know, out of the book. Yeah, doctor, going to the doctor is a good one. You know, you're kind of trying to focus it back to, oh, it was a doctor visit.
Sure.
But I used to say, kids say the darndest things. Kids really say the darndest things when you're doing a sexual assault prevention presentation. So anyway, and then it's a question and answer. And so they'll ask the questions. And I try to end with a couple of funny stories. But when I was at Victim Services Center, I didn't disclose any personal information. I was just the guy here to teach them about consent. We would identify like, what are some characteristics of a victim, you know? And so you get what they say, well, what are characteristics of a rapist or an offender? And, you know, you get scruffy, dirty, you know, you're not thinking, you know, America's dad or all-star basketball player or, you know, Pittsburgh Steeler quarterback. You know, they have these images of these negative people. And we try to just point that out, that 95% of the time when someone's sexually victimized, it's done by someone that they know and trust. Then we would do a values clarification. We'd say, all right, if you agree with this statement, move over here. If you disagree with the statement, move over there. People have the right to change their mind in the middle of sex. Well, and so, you know, you get the guys walk over here and the girls walk over there. And then we discuss, okay, what are some reasons why someone would say stop? You know, I even put in my book, what if they have to take a shit? You know, I mean, maybe it's not to hurt you. It's maybe something's going on. Maybe they were victimized in the past and they're having some type of flashback and they need a moment. I'm like, it's not all about you not being able to do it. I'll tell you what. And I'd look at the guys in the back. I'll tell you what. If you were having sex with her and the daddy pulled up into the driveway, I bet you would stop then and jump out the fucking window. I wouldn't say fuck, but another one is when people say yes, they mean yes. So, you know, everyone would walk to one side. I said, well, let me rephrase it. when people say yes, they always mean yes. And then you had half of the group split up. And so we discussed that. So I really enjoyed it. You know, high school and colleges are my favorite. So that's kind of how what we did. We did it elementary school. We did high school, colleges. Every now and then we do bully in the middle school, but I don't really like that because middle school kids annoy me because they tap a lot. They tap and they always jittery and, you know, they don't pay attention. So above third grade and above up till fifth grade and then, you know, ninth grade to seniors in college, that was my favorite. Now, whenever I travel and do a presentation, I'm usually sharing my story like I did today, like kind of going through that, showing the E60, telling the funny stories. And then I got to share a couple of coincidences. So I had to do a speech in Richmond, Virginia last year, which I loved. It was a great trip. They gave me like 2 hours, which normally I do like 45 minutes with a 15 minute question and answer. But they gave me 2 hours. So I was like, all right, I'll come up with something. And so one of the things that I came up with was not come up with. This is a true story. So in 91, I told y'all we did Geraldo, right? Did I tell you that? Or am I confusing earlier in the day? So 1991, me and my dad go do Geraldo. And the first question that the audience member asked was, how do you trust yourself to go into a public building and start blasting away? So my daddy wasn't ready for that. So my dad looked at him and he said, when I looked down the barrel of that gun, I knew exactly who I was hitting. And I was like, good answer, Daddy. Good answer. So we go to commercial break and I go to say something to Daddy. I look over and he's just staring at that guy. I said, Daddy, cut that shit out. And he's like, okay. So only reason why I went to that show was to go be on TV, right? Well, they filmed two shows that day, kind of like Maury did with LaToya. They filmed two shows that day. And so I got to meet, it was called The Day the Music Died. And they had Buddy Holly's wife on there. I got to meet her. Then they had Peggy Sue, the real Peggy Sue. I got to meet her. Then Richie Valens' Donna, I met her. And then the third or the fourth guest that was a special guest was Little Richard. So I got to meet Little Richard. And I was like, that is freaking awesome. I got to meet Little Richard too. What a great trip to New York. Well, that show did not air until June of 91. So it aired a couple months later. 2 days after the show aired, I get a call from Mike Barnett with the sheriff's office, same guy. He called me and he said, I want you to notice. He goes, we just arrested this pastor who'd been molesting these two kids. And one of them came forward and he said he saw you on the Geraldo show and that's why he came forward. So here I am, you know, when people go, well, if I can only help one, I helped two and I wasn't even trying. So that's the moment that I was like, okay, I'm going to speak out. I'm going to share my story. I'm going to try to inspire others and let people know that they can be okay. But you want to know what the weird thing is? The day the music died, February 3rd, 1959, is the day Jeff was born.
Wow.
Is that not crazy?
That's wild.
See, I always feel like there's always synchronicities and trauma with anything, just like these little signs or these little weird things that are just like add up. Like my mom left her John, if you know my story, she left John the same day, March 7th, like a year apart from each other. So it was like so weird that just sometimes these things happen.
I did read up, you know, because I was like, well, let me familiarize myself a little bit more because I saw your name up at Comic-Con and I was like, oh, that's awesome. About the August 20th, about how that was the day that they all kind of got together. So it replaced the August. It was the People magazine or the People thing. And so I thought that was kind of cool as well.
Yeah, no, that was very special to me. And I was very thankful for that day, like as a part of my journey. And, you know, it's a day to celebrate from now on.
Right. Absolutely. Well, speaking of celebrating, on March 16th, the 40th anniversary of the shooting, I will be in Austin, Texas at the Mothership Comedy Club, which is Joe Rogan's comedy club. He actually mentioned my dad a couple months ago on the show. And my favorite comedian, Jim Norton, is going to be there. I mentioned Jim in the book.
That's cool.
All right. So what happened was back in like 2011, Opie and Anthony got a phone call because Jim used to be on the Opie and Anthony show. They got a phone call about, oh, if you go look at this video, a guy in the airport, New Orleans, guns down this guy. So they started commenting. They showed the video and they were commenting on it and talking about it. And they're going, oh, you could bring a gun to the airport. Yeah, you could do that back then. And so Jim has this character, Uncle Paul. I reference Uncle Paul in the movie and in the book. And Uncle Paul is a pedophile. So when they started showing the video, Jim goes, hey, there's my karate friend. And that's Uncle Paul. So he's like, yes, we would play judo. He's my karate friend. That guy's a boy's a liar. You know, and it's funny. One time he did this thing where he was molesting baby Hitler, which is probably the most inappropriate thing I've listened to, but it's freaking hilarious. So I went to see Jim at a show one time. And after he would take pictures with the audience, he'd have his like personal assistant take pictures. Then he would upload them to the internet. And if you wanted a picture of you and Jim, you just go download it. It saved time. It just got people moving. So we're waiting in line. There's a big line. We're in Dallas. And when I get to Jim, I'm like, hey, Jim, I'm Jody Ploche. My dad's the guy that shot the guy at the airport. So Jim reaches in his back pocket, gets his phone, and is like, here, let's take a selfie. I'm going to send this to Anthony. So all these people are in line watching Jim take a selfie with me. And they're like wondering, like, who the fuck is this guy? So, you know, over the years, I'd email Jim and, you know, he responded back every now and then. So I was heading to Pennsylvania to do a speaking engagement. I was going to go to New York City for a couple of days. Well, I saw Jim was performing at the Fat Black Pussycat, a new hour, and it was only a $5 cover charge and 2-drink minimum. I'm like, well, I'll do that in a heartbeat. The 2-drink minimum is not going to be a problem. And so me and my friend Tiffany go to see Jim at the Fat Black Pussycat. Well, he goes to a new hour's worth of material, and now he's trying to do crowd work. So he looks at this guy who was sitting with a woman, and he's like, what's your favorite genre of porn? And the guy wouldn't answer him. So Jim looks at the crowd and he's like, somebody, what's your favorite genre of porn? And Tiffany yells out, anal. And Jim immediately looked at her and goes, ma'am, do you know who you're sitting next to? That's my friend Jody. And when Jody was younger, and he looks at me and he goes, is it okay? And I'm like, sure, go ahead. And he's like, he was kidnapped and sexually abused, and his father ended up shooting him and then not going to jail. So Tiffany's like, oh my God, Jody, I'm so sorry. Next thing you know, I'm waving at the crowd because they're giving me a big, I said, Tiffany, I said, my favorite comedian just introduced me to the crowd in New York City. I'm okay with you yelling out anal. Trust me. It was great. So I tried to include that. I did include that story in the book. I kind of forced it in because I wanted to tell it. But anyway, so I'll be celebrating with Jim Norton at the Joe Rogan's Comedy Club on March 16th, the 40th anniversary. And I had some replica hats made, the baseball cap that my dad had on. He had worked previously for a company called Riverland. So while he was working for Head and Inquis, he's wearing a Riverland shirt hat on. I mean, he could at least give an advertisement to Head and Inquis. But so someone asked me a couple of months ago on Twitter, they were like, what logo was on your dad's hat? So I found an old business card and I posted it. Well, whoever it was is like an art graphic designer, made like a screenshot art ready to go. So I was able to upload it to a white baseball cap on Amazon. And they're able to make an exact replica of it. My brother, he ordered not an exact replica, but he ordered like a one that had like blue on it with white on the front. But he had the same logo. So, you know, who knows if the documentary series gets picked up and things are going well, maybe we'll have some merch to sell. But I'm not big on that. Let's just do a good documentary and go from there.
There you go.
I love that. Well, I think that's the perfect note to wrap up on. Is there anything else you want to share or have survivors know about if they're going through this type of situation at all?
Again, I think there's a lot of good information in my book for survivors, and you can get that on Amazon, but you also can go to Audible. So like a year and a half ago, a friend of mine who has done several audiobooks has a studio in his house. He was going to be, if we couldn't get it done today, I was going to ask him if I could
remember.
Go.
Yeah.
So it's out on Audible as well. If you want to listen to it, and if you're out there and you don't have the funds, email me and I'll send you a link to a free download.
That's awesome.
It was so nice to finally get to talk to y'all. Y'all's story is inspiring. And what y'all are doing is great.
Thank you so much for coming on today. Like, today was amazing, and the information that you have shared. And usually when we have on sexual assault survivors that are going through their story, it's not as there's not as much comedy in it.
it's a little heavier.
Yeah, I try, I mean, but that's me. I can't help it, you know. I mean some people, I did a interview a couple weeks ago or whatever, and someone, I told this story about Jim Norton, and someone in the comment was like, that was kind of a sick story to tell. And I'm like, but then don't watch Jim Norton. I'm just telling you what happened.
You know, everybody's got an opinion about everything nowadays, but at the end of the day, you made it through. You're changing people's lives. You're having an impact in ways that you didn't even realize you were having at such a young age. And that's what this is all about, right? You know, I always say to Tara, we're all a part of a squad that no one really wants to be a part of.
Terrible club.
Yeah. But we are all a part of the Survivor Squad. Jodi Plochet, thank you so much for joining the program. We will have links to all of Jodi's social media and where to purchase the book in the links of the show notes of today's episode. Jodi, thank you so much.
Thank y'all.
Wow, Tara. Tyler was not kidding. That is a wild story.
Oh, yes. No, I'm really excited that we reached out to him again because we were connected a while ago. We were going to record with Jodi.
And it was like a year ago.
Yes. And then a technical glitch or something happened that day. And then we talked about rescheduling and then never did until a year later.
Yeah. But we got him on and he shares his incredible story. And it's just, it's amazing that he was able to turn his trauma. I mean, so many, you know, so many people would, you know, at that. And it's weird because he was like that age that I was when I went through all my shit. You know what I mean? And it's incredible to see him do something positive with his life because so many people would have been taken down the wrong, you know, the wrong road and not been able to like get it together after that. And the way that he was able to still have a, you know, obviously a relationship with his father and his family and all of that is just, it's very incredible. And it really speaks well to Jodi's character and who he is as a person and how he's been able to turn his trauma into triumph and be a beacon of hope for other survivors of sexual assault, sexual violence, especially children who are coming to terms and coming to grips with that type of physical abuse.
Yes. No, I love that Jodi's really put his pain into purpose and he shows definitely the progression side of the trauma, where if you don't have that, you really aren't going to move forward with your trauma. If you stay in that negative conversation of, you know, my trauma sucks, everything sucks, the world sucks, everything, you're not going to get better. So turning your pain into purpose is so important with trauma.
Yeah, it is. Big shout out to Jodi for coming on the program. We will have links to all of his stuff in the show notes of today's episode. So as we mentioned at the top of the program, we are going to take about a 4-month hiatus with the show to sort of regroup. We're both focusing on some different projects. Tara, what do you have going on?
Well, I want to be done with telling my story. So I'm working on a few things. I'm working on a podcast. I'm working on a documentary, possible doc. And I'm also working on a book. And I know that I don't have an agent or anything like that. It's just I'm working on it all and I'm going to get it done and I'm going to get it out there. And that's why the 4-month hiatus is going to be great because in 4 months we can kick some ass.
That's wonderful. And you're going to be working on your YouTube channel, which you're going to have additional episodes and interviews coming out as well. And we will have some additional stuff coming up on the Patreon in the meantime to keep you guys sort of abreast on what's going on with the podcast. And of course, the podcast will still be available. You can listen to all of our back catalog where, you know, we have 83 or 84 episodes, something like that, for you guys to listen to, 85, I believe now, that you guys can check out while we're in our hiatus. And we are so grateful for you guys, our audience, helping us grow, the love and support and the outpouring of fan mail that you guys have given us. We're so grateful for all of that. And this has been such a labor of love for us, but we're looking forward to new chapters and horizons in our lives. And we can't wait to come back with you guys in the summer and kick ass.
Yes, yes. We'll see you just in time for my birthday.
I think so.
Until next time, survivors, I'm Tara Newell.
And I'm Collier Landry.
And this is the Survivor Squad podcast.
We'll see you guys. The Survivor Squad podcast is made possible by support from listeners just like you. Please subscribe via Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. And please consider supporting this program by visiting our Patreon page at patreon.com/Survivor Squad.